closer.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Pre-Accident Investigation Podcast. I'm Todd Conklin, and I'll be your host for today if you will let me. If you're not going to let me, tell me now, and I'll back away, and you can do this all by yourself, although I will tell you some of the context will have been removed. So I'm not going to spend a whole bunch of time today. Thanks for tuning in. It means a lot. Always great. Tell your friends, more is better. Subscribe, please. That makes a difference. But let's get right to it. I'm going to start today's podcast by reading an excerpt to you from an email, and it starts like this. The thesis you are working on is quite remarkable in its scope and depth. You shame us all in showing how little we've covered the literature in this field. I've not read the thesis too closely because the ideas were simply too stimulating. I had to see where it was headed, so I skipped to the end, and now I have some observations. I think there is a huge theoretical difference between the concept of sense-making as applied to a thoughtful, mindful individual and the concept of joint or collective sense-making as applied to a group either after an event or, more importantly, during an event. I think you want your organization to pay less attention to the training of expert bosses who will then tell everyone what to do in a crisis and pay more attention to that same boss creating a moment of dialogue in situ to collectively figure out what is going on and what to do next. This is a bold, difficult, and probably correct idea. Now, the reason I read that to you is because the signature on this email is Edgar Schein. And if you've not read Schein and his understanding of organizational culture and how organizations function in order to provide value, it's time. A comment like that from Schein is probably about as good as it gets. And that leads us into the next podcast. This is Ivan Popolitti. You've met him before. A couple podcasts ago, he was telling us sort of about his work in the Forest Service. Today, he's going to talk about his work around something he calls a learning review. In fact, the language of accident investigation is shifting, and it should shift, and it's shifting towards this notion of a learning review. Listen carefully to some of the concepts he talks about, because at the end of this podcast, I'm giving you a quiz on how you can change the way you manage risk and learning in your event. Without any further ado, ladies and gentlemen, here is Ivan Popolitti, Pup, on learning review. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, so you just are finishing up your dissertation. In fact, you go to defense in a couple months, right?
That's right, September 1st.
So what do we need to know about your defense? What's your work? Give me a thumbnail sketch, if I may say this, kind of a non-technical sketch of what your dissertation does. Bring me up to speed.
Sure. Okay, well, the dissertation's kind of a chronology, case study of the transformation of the Forest Service from an organization of blame to an organization that makes sense of accidents and incidents. And a big part of that is this concept of understanding. And the way we got to this was we started looking very deeply and very heavily at how people were being treated by our investigation process. And what we found out is that people were being blamed and shamed in the process of investigation, frequently for their own death. And it was tacitly unfair.
And that was built into the process, you're saying?
It was literally built into the process.
Wow, that's crazy.
It is crazy. But I think, you know, if we look at a lot of processes are like that, Todd. A lot of the processes do that. And, you know, a couple of times I've been asked, well, why did processes evolve to that point? You know, why did they start looking at people as failed components in the system? And or as bad things?
Yeah, temporarily incompetent, yeah. I'm with you.
Yeah. And near as I can tell, I mean, there's all kinds of social implications around this that go much, much deeper than the present. But there's some recency around this belief, too. And the recency that I uncover in the dissertation is around the mechanical analysis of accidents and incidents that was so effective in the 70s. And so in the 70s, all of a sudden, we're making big strides to reduce the mechanical failures. And the models that we're using for that are technical models.
Right, because they're technical machines, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
And it works. And if you have a bad part, well, that really makes sense. It is, in fact, a bad part. So a mechanical bad part, you take it out, and you replace it with a good part. Well, I think that there was a natural transference of that to these socio-technical models. Well, the Forest Service is a really unique organization in that we have very little that is involved with technology. In fact, you could argue in wildland firefighting, I mean, we're basically doing the same thing, throwing dirt, and we have been doing it for 100 years. We create a line by scratching dirt in the ground, and we hope that that line holds when the fire comes to it, and that's the whole purpose of it, remove the fuel. And
everything is fuel.
Some, and everything is fuel.
Some just has doors and windows.
Exactly.
That's terrible.
It is terrible. But it is. I mean, there is some truth to this because fire is part of the natural landscape, and we're starting to realize that. So part of the transformation that the Forest Service goes through, which is also uncovered in the dissertation, is this understanding that we started off with this protectionist attitude where we had to protect this resource. And if you think back 1910, 1905, that time frame, the equivalent of oil in the United States was timber. Timber,
sure.
Sidewalks, timber roads, timber rails, timber for fuel for our houses to keep warm, timber to build the houses to begin with, timber to power the locomotives. I mean, everything was around timber at the time. So that resource was very important to protect. But the strategy of protection caused a few problems down the road, and those problems were increased fuel loading. So we started looking at this as a problem of effective firefighting. It doesn't really mitigate the risk that day. What it does is it transfers the risk downstream. So the next generation has to deal with increased fuel loading. Some of the people who really study this are telling me 4 to 6 times that the natural fuel loading is what we have in the forests right
wow,
now.
Wow, really?
It's intense.
Because we just don't allow fires to burn.
Right.
Right? Yeah, okay.
Exactly. And so now we've got a whole bunch, from a very effective smoky campaign, only you can prevent forest fires, now we have this increased fuel loading. Well, what that was really was a realization that we were dealing with a complex adaptive system that didn't respond to stimulus the way we thought it would. And it kind of led us to, in the overall Forest Service, it's leading us now to a different schema for wildland fire management. In fact, we're kind of thinking that in some circles, there's a thought and a discussion that we shouldn't even call our people firefighters because they shouldn't really be fighting fire. At best, they should be managing fire. And maybe the answer is really that they should be managing fuel. So these are the kinds of things that we're kind of gravitating to. The tie-in to this and the dissertation and the work that we're doing in accident investigation kind of flows naturally in that we start to recognize again that we're dealing with a complex adaptive system.
Gotcha.
And one that is not technical. A non-technical laboratory to look at social interactions and to look at a laboratory where there are really very few, if any, normative standards. So error really is almost always only determined when we know the outcome.
Right.
Which is a phenomenal opportunity.
Right.
I mean, there's no checklist that says your light switch should be on and you didn't turn the light switch on. We don't have that kind of normative standard.
Gotcha.
So it's really kind of interesting to look at that. And then as we started going in with these socio-technical models that were prevalent in the birth of the 70s and 80s, what we found was they just didn't apply. They didn't apply well. They didn't transfer well. There may be application for them in certain areas, but in complex adaptive systems, they started to fall apart because the accident that happened today, the way it happened, will never happen again. And that's a big realization when we start to get to that part.
Well, that's huge, right?
Oh, it's huge. Yeah, and it moves us away from what you often say. It moves us away from looking at the consequence. And we've been saying that now in the Forest Service for a while as well, that we shouldn't be driven by consequence. If we use the consequence to determine if the action or decision was an error, we're way, way off base.
I agree. And the consequence isn't even very interesting.
No.
Right? I mean, it could be tragic and horrible, but it's not very interesting.
Yeah,
a guy falls 50 feet, the outcome is pretty knowable, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And that's interesting. And I think what you're saying is really, I'm excited about your work because this is pretty aggressive. It's definitely new view. It's kind of postmodern view. I mean, this is really pushing people out there. And this is a big lumbering agency that is starting to have discussions that other agencies aren't even close to ready to have, right? I mean,
yeah, I mean, I'd like to think differently, but I think you're right. I've been to a bunch of different agencies that are very interested in this. that have had me out to give presentations about the process and want me back to try and teach their personnel how to do this type of review. We don't call it an investigation anymore. We've literally changed the name to learning review.
Nice.
Yeah, it really is. And the way we started, we had a bunch of folks that were trained like me as a linear accident investigator, looking for evidence and cause and effect relationships, and then reducing those cause and effect relationships to findings and recommendations. And so we had internal strife around this, and we had to come to some resolve. And the way we did that is we enjoined the community in a discussion, a nationwide dialogue. We held 8 focus groups around the nation that involved these subject matter experts, safety specialists, occupational and safety health professionals. And we sat down and we talked with them. And I got to tell you, you know, failure's a good thing. Because the very first meeting was an abysmal failure. It was terrible. People were yelling at one another. It was not pleasant. But went out to the hall with the other two main coordinators, our Director of Occupational Safety and Health, Steve Schlentz, and John Phipps, who's been a leader in this movement all along. And the three of us talked in the hallway, and I said, guys, what we've got to do is we've got to back off. We've got to forget about the morning. We've lost it 4 hours down the drain. What we've got to do is we've got to go in for the next 4 hours and talk about principle. And Steve went, principle? You want to talk about principle? Yeah. I want to take the next 4 hours, but we've only got another 8 hours to talk with them. I said, yeah, this is important. Trust me. We've got to talk about principle. And so we sat down, and collectively, every single person in the room agreed that we wanted to do no further harm to the system or the people within the system. And this became a guiding principle for the rest of our discussions. And we actually developed 12 principles in all, which is probably too many, probably more than we needed. But every time we came to a point in the discussion that was contentious, we referred back to the principles, and they grounded us and brought us back to an understanding that we're not here for ourselves or for the thing that we want to advocate. We're here for the people who can benefit from this learning. We also recognized another thing, that this concept of prevention has been really, really muddled. This idea of preventing the next accident based on the last one.
Yeah, isn't that silly?
Kind of crazy.
Well, it is. I mean, it's silly. It's just silly, because the whole notion, you said it earlier, you know, people, you can go to giant companies. There are people listening right now who will tell you the reason they do accident investigations is to prevent repeat occurrences. That is just, I don't know how we did that to people. Where did that come from, and why did that become so important?
Yeah, that's a really hard question to ask, but I think it's a mechanical model that drives us to that, an idea that we're going to develop reliability in machines and reliability in people at the same time, when that may not be what we want in a complex adaptive system. So when we think about complex systems, what they deliver is uncertainty, and we can't meet uncertainty or that which is uncertain or unknown with a process, because you can't write a process for something that you don't know about. And the idea of writing a process for everything, especially in a dynamic environment like wildland fire that's changing moment to moment, trying to write a process for every bit of that is going to be impossible, or a rule or a regulation. It's kind of crazy. So what we need is we need people acting in the moment to develop innovations that fit the conditions that they're facing at that moment. And so at first, the Forest Service really deeply embraced a lot of intuitive thinking around this, and thinking that intuition was much more accurate than deliberate or deliberation. And what I realized rather quickly in doing the dissertation was that what we had done is we had described the extremes. So decision and action, decision on one side, action on another. We described the extremes. But people never operate in the extremes. They're always someplace in the middle. There's always, in every decision, there's some component of intuition. In every intuitive response, there's still some component of deliberation.
Sure, sure.
And so in that, we finally came to the conclusion, why tear them apart? So we don't even do that anymore. We now refer to action decision. And what we look to try and do with our process, our learning review process, is to put the action decision in context. And the context that we're looking for are the conditions that influenced decisions and actions. So one of the chapters...
And every action, every decision will have context.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Every one of them. And the context will be interrelated. You'll see the same conditions throughout the event.
Over and over again. Right.
And event to event. So if we can develop some sort of sensitivity to conditions in our workforce, what would that do for us, was our question. So we entered into kind of a social experiment on this.
But, well, you know there's a whole... universe of safety professionals who have been taught their entire career to ignore condition.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they've been taught that you don't go out and observe conditions, you go out and observe behaviors.
Yes.
And that every, I don't know how many times I've heard this, 90% of all accidents, and by the way, this is complete bullshit, this is made up, 90% of all accidents happen because of at-risk behavior. But that's ingrained into people. I mean, there are people listening right now who at their fundamental core believe that. And how do we get them to understand that we are terrible at managing outcomes, but we're actually very good at understanding conditions?
Well, you know, that's a super lead into one of the problems that we had in the dialogue sessions that we were doing around the country with the occupational safety and health professionals. Because OSHA will always tell us that we failed to provide a workplace free from known hazard. And for me, that was immediately a point at which I understood that this tension that you're talking about is both alive and well and fostered in an environment that doesn't apply to us. And here's why. We pay our people hazard pay. How do we go into an environment that is created by the employer as free from known hazards when we pay hazard pay?
Oh, you're absolutely, absolutely right.
And so as firefighters, this is already, we're already in violation. It's like we might as well just stand up and take it, understand that we're going to have that violation walking in. But there's more to it than that. It's not that the people from occupational safety and health are ill or ill-meaning or...
Oh, no. It's quite the opposite of that.
And it's quite the opposite of that. But what we have to start to understand is that it within our workforce does not perform in a risky way, but they have to take risk in order to do their job. So now what we have to start to understand is how risk is normalized in every society, in every person, all the time, because risk is constantly normalized. And I think that as we start to recognize that, we start to bring in the work of John Adams, for example, and we start to understand balancing behaviors, we start to see that these are there are things that manipulate, influence, move us in certain ways to do certain things. And so it becomes that idea of influence as opposed to the idea of cause that becomes really important to us. So let me take you on a little journey around that. If we talk about cause-effect relationships, we're constantly in the business of trying to prove that there is a cause-effect relationship.
Classic Newtonian thinking.
Classic Newtonian thinking and scientific method. So we're always either in verification or falsification. But if we want to have a dialogue about the things that are extant in our system that are influencing our people instead of causing our people to do things, all of a sudden the world opens to a different dialogue. If you think about, I'm influenced by this, now there's no need to prove because we're not trying to evaluate it. We're not trying to place a numerical value on something. So we can talk about fatigue rather openly. We can talk about a lot of the other things that are in our system that are blocked in dialogue because we don't have the data. Now we know if it exists inside the system, it's an influence. Now we can start talking about it. And what we recognize is that it's not even a single thing like fatigue. It's usually a multitude of things that are acting independently and interdependently in the system.
Gotcha.
And those things are influencing us and influencing each person uniquely. So everybody brings their own heuristics, their own biases, their own experience, their own training, and that is going to factor into that influence as well. If we can start an emerging dialogue amongst our workers around the topic of conditions, we accelerate the learning in a really unique way. So we started off with safety one, safety two. That was our original model. And what we really recognized rather quickly was that there was a safety three, and the safety three was developing this concept of expertise. And the expertise is around recognition of changes in the environment. The changes in the environment are changes in condition. And so that's become our target. Our target is that type of learning out of our learning reviews.
So really all workers would have some level of safety three, your safety three concept. Of course, longer term workers would have probably better safety three ability,
mm-hmm.
but young, fresh eyes would also bring different safety three ability. This is interesting. Tell
exactly.
me more.
So this incident, an incident that we had in 2013 was a fatality smoke jumper incident, ground firefighting incident. And the firefighter was hit by a falling snag. And what we started to recognize in this is the importance of sense making and the quick ability for people to drop into routine, right? So if our people are dropping into routine, we've got to ask why. Why did it make sense for them to drop into routine? This was one of the key action decisions, was dropping into routine. And so to develop this idea or this understanding, we went to Carl Weick and we spent a lot of time with Carl. I mean, side by side for day after day after day, going over the incident and going over the interactions with focus groups in the community and trying to understand why that might make sense and what we could do about it. So what we came up with was two things. One, we wanted to try and initiate sense-making in some way. This is the recognition of changes inside the environment. But we also wanted to recognize the environment's potential to do harm. And this was a problem because everybody thinks about this in terms of the standard risk, green, amber, red, or something
right,
like
right.
that.
Right, right. Classic risk management.
Exactly. But what we found there was that person to person, the values of risk were always in conflict. And risk discussions in a hierarchical environment or even in a planar environment with peers, discussions about risk are always going to be discussions around risk values. And that was problematic to us. We wanted to change it. What we changed the argument to was something that David Woods turned us on to a while ago and something that we used in aviation, and it was called margin of maneuver. And we've since shortened it to margin. And the idea is you can build margin into your mission ahead of time, and you can look at that using the standard risk management processes, and in fact, we encourage that. But once you've accepted that you're going to do the mission and you're now engaged with the environment, now you're no longer dealing with what you can project or predict is going to happen. Now you're dealing with the uncertainty.
And so you build rumble strips, margins.
Yeah.
Edges.
Yeah, rumble strips is a good metaphor for
upper,
it.
Upper, lower thresholds, controls, lines, whatever you want to call them. I mean, those are all really linear and
yeah.
probably not the best example. But rumble strips are really kind of what you want to talk about. When this happens, when this condition is present, this happens, right?
Yeah. And
yeah, okay.
And the this that happens is, I mean, some organizations would call it stop work, but that's not within the DNA of the Forest Service. We're kind of a can-do organization.
Well, you're firefighters.
And we're firefighters. Stopping work may not be the most conducive thing to do for safety in the environment. I mean, we can't just simply stop sometimes. It's kind of like an aircraft. When it stops in the air, bad things happen,
yeah.
right?
Bernoulli's Law.
Exactly. So what we wanted to do is we wanted to move to a sense-making model. And this is where Carl really helped us to understand that if we sense that margins are decreasing, then that is an indicator that we need to do something different. Now, we're not going to be prescriptive about what that something is. We're not going to say, well, you've got to stop work. But the sense maker in the organization, whomever is designated as the sense maker in the crew on the division at the IC level, that person is going to now take the role of making sense of the situation and start to expand the information, start to gather more information if necessary.
Which happens anyway, right?
I mean, happens anyway.
Don't people do this anyway?
Absolutely. Which is one of the reasons why our accident rate is so low. And so that's another thing that we've got to recognize about this. When we talk about accidents in the Forest Service, we're talking about less than 1%. Now, less than 1% is still a pretty high number, and that's the tragedy of it. We've lost somewhere in the neighborhood of an average of seven and a half firefighters a year for the last 20 years. Some numbers are higher than that. We don't have a really good way of calculating the numbers of lost firefighters. We calculate them along certain categories, but not along other categories. This is another problem, but I'm digressing. If we kind of get back to the idea here, what we're trying to do is we're trying to develop a sense-making community that it can reside in one person, and if the situation is complex enough, it will be able to be rapidly expanded to group sense making. And the trigger for that is understanding the changes in margin. And then we also use margin after the fact as well, and in a way of looking at after action reviews. How did margin change, and how did we react to changes in margin? Where did we miss changes in margin? Because the other thing about increasing margin is now we've got the opportunity to really, really excel. We can put in our second team like they do in sports, if you want to use that kind of a metaphor. But we can take more risk with the environment if it's conducive, right?
And the margins
are wide.
Are wide.
Yeah.
And what you manage is the space between the margins.
That's it. Exactly.
So let me ask this question. Fukushima.
Ooh, interesting question.
The risk assessment for the seawall was based on a 100-year study.
Mm-hmm.
Margins were based on a 100-year study. The tsunami actually met a 1,000-year test, did they not make the margins large enough? Well, how do you guess what the margins are?
You know, when you go back to the socio-technical model, you're always going to be pushed back into an economic assessment. What's the economic balance, the cost-benefit analysis, or cost-benefit ratio of establishing a system wherein if we spend this much money to reinforce the wall for 1,000 years, will it ever happen? Right.
Right.
And that's who knows. Right?
But I think what you're saying is really important, because most risk assessment that is done now is done around a Western economic model. Cost-benefit. Really, in fact, I will tell you, all hazard assessments, probability times severity, are really done to manage resource, not to manage risk. You're actually turning that on its ear.
In a big way.
But it's not expensive way. You're just saying, this won't cost more or less. I mean, it's really not an impact to the cost. What you're saying is we're not using an economic model that is counting on some kind of predictive performance. We're using a model that has margins, rumble strips, that actually counts on multiple forms of variability coexisting at the same time.
Absolutely. And let's add a little depth to the rumble strip idea.
Sure.
Rumble strip represents part of it.
Oh, yeah.
But the other part of it is a social understanding that the margin is changing just because the system is changing. So the system's dynamic, so the margins within the system will change dynamically. So it could be my fatigue, my crew's fatigue, it could be the fire, the wind, the environment, changes in fuel type, super, super heated days like we have in the middle of August. These are some of the conditions that we want to think about. All of them affect margin, but none of them affect margin linearly. In other words, none of them, you can't put them on a chart and say, well, for this ERC, for this temperature, for this humidity, we're going to end up with this kind of fire behavior. Because the problem is we really don't always know how fuels are going to behave, and we don't know how micro weather phenomenon could affect the fuels in a particular area. Now, that's just around fire. Now think about, there are other aspects of this as well. There's the individual, the crew. There's all kinds of dynamics of conditions that affect margin. So, and they're interrelated. So on a hot day in high altitude, our aircraft are going to perform in a poorer way. They're going to have lower performance.
Right.
So they're not going to be able to haul the loads that they would otherwise. So they're going to have to make more trips to supply the troops on the line. So, and the troops on the line are going to require more water because it's hotter. And they're going to be exposed to more heat stress. So we've got, again, a nonlinear relationship here with regard to simply temperature and the effects that it has interrelated throughout the system.
When you did your book report, your giant book report, that's what I like to call it. Where else will these ideas apply?
Oh, just about everywhere. So if we drop back and we take a look at any circumstance that involves people, there is a social network that exists. We've spent a lot of time on analyzing the social technical interface. We haven't spent a lot of time looking at the social interface. And the social interface is really all around these conditions. How are we relating in terms of communication? How are we relating to each other in terms of sharing information? And it suddenly becomes a broader look at relationships, and a very important look at relationships. Now, what we've done is we've kind of simplified that look at relationships in terms of the conditions that influence decisions and actions. And those conditions then become the topic of our discussion. I had a great opportunity. I was teaching the learning review at a Forest Service function a couple of weeks ago, and one of the people came up to me during it, and he said, well, I went someplace, and I mentioned Saddleback, this one accident, and nobody knew what it was. And I said, okay, did they know what margin was? Oh, yeah, they knew about margin. I said, then they got the learning from the event. We don't need to tie it to the catastrophic outcome.
The consequence.
We don't need to tie to that. And to some degree, we don't even need to tie to the story. What we need to start to do is develop the learning out of it.
Right.
And that learning can emerge in a lot of different ways. So one thing that we did want to try and capitalize on this, though, through the research, what we found was we'd been writing reports that tried to do a bunch of different things. They tried to protect the agency from lawsuit. They tried to prevent the next accident based on what was learned. They tried to put in recommendations for new rules, regulations, policies, and procedures, which honestly could only fit the last accident, which is one of the reasons that we've got so many rules, regulations,
sure,
policies.
Sure, everywhere, that's true.
Everywhere.
Closing the barn door after the cow escapes. Right.
Exactly. So instead of looking at things as decisions, what we started to do is we started to think again about what were these things. These things were really innovations at the point of work. Holnagel likes to say adaptations, and the same adaptations that result in success result in failure. And Decker says this quite well as well. So as we start to look at this, these adaptations become interesting to us, not in terms of them being an error, because they could only be judged error based on the outcome. Instead, they become interesting to us because they were probably effective until this event. So now what we want to try and do is we want to try and recognize where innovation is taking place. Capture and begin to understand those innovations. If we can start spending some time on that, all of a sudden we move to the normal work. We start looking at normal work. And as we start to look at normal work, we start looking at the way people are adapting at point of work. And then we can assess that in terms of, is it consistent with the company's values? Is it consistent with the regulations? Do the regulations need to be changed? Why does it make sense for the person to do this? And we don't place language on it like error or shortcut or
process improvement, or
that's the language we like to use. Is we like to think of it as it could be process improvement. This could be a real innovation. It could also be a workaround. But we need to spend time in normal work to try and understand that. So what we found is that the learning review concept really applies to normal work, to incidents, and to accidents equally well. And so we've run it several times on a bunch of different things. We had a laptop theft. A guy had a laptop stolen, actually, right here in Albuquerque. And he was absolutely crushed by it. And we looked at this from the perspective of why did it make sense for him to do the things that he did leading up to that theft, right? Now, who was the victim here, right?
United States government.
And the poor guy.
Yeah, the guy whose laptop.
Yeah, I mean, if you have something stolen from you, you're the victim, right? And the old system would have vilified him. In fact, the old system would have turned him over to human relations. Human relations would have sent him up to wherever they go for whatever kind of investigation they're going to do. And the net result of that would have been some punitive action. We forestalled that. And instead, what we went to was what could be learned from this event? How could we leverage this into something that could help the greater community? And then, here's the greatest part of this thing, as far as I'm concerned, is that we no longer, as accident investigators, had the responsibility to come up with the wonderful recommendations. Instead, what we did was we grabbed people from the community of practice. We said, here are the influences and why this incident, why this action decision made sense, or this innovation even, why it made sense. Here is what we now understand about that. Now, what can we do to improve the system? And so the recommendations now are based on what can we do to improve the system. And it's transformational.
Oh, totally.
And the workforce loves it because now they're involved in giving us input on how the system can be improved. And frankly, they have a lot of knowledge about this, dealing with it every day. They're the subject matter experts on how the system can be improved.
Absolutely.
And so we're finally.
So what are you going to do with it? Book? What do you think?
Well, I don't know. Several people are talking me into doing a book with it, so I think I'll probably pursue that. I think.
Yeah, why not? It's already written. I mean, the hard part's kind of out of the way.
And it's not like I hate it. I mean, some people have told me that you'll hate your dissertation when you're done with it. I don't.
Yeah, I do.
I'm not sure I like the process much, but I like the dissertation.
I hated everything about it. I was glad it's over. So. Well, thanks for that. That was really, really good. That was a good overview, and we appreciate it. We got her done?
Got her done.
Sounds good, brother. What'd you think? Probably going to have to listen to that one twice. Here's my quiz to you. I told you it was coming. What'd you learn? Because here's what I'll tell you. This notion that all of us are kind of coming to the same place, I find incredibly encouraging and quite honestly reinforcing. We don't manage consequence. We're fixated on consequence, and our organizations are completely fixated. We manage those conditions, and we look at those margins. I hope you enjoyed this as much as we did. It was a fun one to put together. Any comments or questions, contact us, no problem at all. You'll hear more from this. I think you'll appreciate it. Always have fun. Try to learn something every day. And for goodness sakes, be safe. See you next time.